It's going to be a little messy today, I think. It's going to be great. Oh, you should pray for us, though.
All right. Lord, help us do good.
Yes. Amen. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Cinema Faith Podcast for April 2025. I'm your host, Jonathan Buchan, and I'm joined once again by the world's most undercover spy, Tim Nelson.
Dun-da-rum-bum.
Tim, that whole chaplain hospital disguise thing isn't fooling anyone. We know you're spying. It's okay. Just admit it.
It's true. I have been using it as a cover. It's like sleight of hand, but with my whole self.
it's just a little unbelievable, I'm going to be honest. But that's okay. Just go back to the agency, maybe work up a new cover. It's fine.
You know, they don't have a chunky spy like
they
in
don't.
The mix. Like, why do all spies look like they're like got 30-inch waists? And yeah, like,
yeah,
they should have a chunky spy. Nobody would like ever guess the chunky spy. I could be that guy.
Totally.
The chunky spy.
We need more representation, because then it's more, yeah, it's not as obvious if you just got normal people out there. It's great. Yeah.
Yeah. So like a chunky middle-aged spy. I guess it's kind of like Dr. Brown.
Dr. Brown?
He's an investigator on PBS. I guess after you're done with your spy career, your Pierce Brosnaning,
right,
and you put on a few pounds, then maybe you go to becoming an investigator in a small town where there's two murders a week.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. But you're totally right. If you were just in the coffee shop, just chilling, sipping coffee, I wouldn't think you were a spy. If Michael Fassbender looked like that, and I would be like, that guy's up to something. I don't know.
He looks like a spy.
Totally. All right. Hey, how you been? This is our first podcast of the 2025 movie season. So exciting. So there's a whole brand new season coming for us. We should probably finish 2024, though, by talking about the Oscars, which felt like it was 10 years ago, but it actually was only a couple weeks ago.
Was it really only a couple weeks ago?
I think so. Everything's moving so fast. I mean, it was like March, right? It was the beginning of March. Okay, so it was a month ago.
Mm.
Yeah. So Conan O'Brien hosted, and I thought he did a great job. I liked his opening the substance thing. I thought it was like that joke worked because it was actually like really legitimately disgusting. And like a little too much. And yeah, so did you watch the whole thing? First of all, I didn't even ask.
No, John saw me just now and I was nodding and I said nothing and he knew that I was not lying. I was lying.
I've learned over the years. You're,
yeah.
Yeah.
I'm like, oh yeah, substance.
Your BS.
I didn't see that opening. I didn't see that opening. Of course I didn't. John, what happened in that opening?
He, Conan O'Brien came out of the body of Demi Moore to like host, and then he like left his pants and shoes in there, so he had to go back in, and it was like very graphic makeup work, and so it was just really gross. Yeah, it's great.
That's super strange. It is Conan-y, though.
It's Conan. But like this, it was, if you've seen The Substance, that you would make more sense. But anyway, so I thought that was good. And I like Conan because he just has this, you know, humor where it's kind of like, it's he like specializes in dumb humor, but you know he's a smart guy. He went to Harvard, so there's also like this kind of comic brilliance underneath it. So I always like Conan, but he did a good job.
I think he does his best work when he's doing his, like, mocking his history.
Yeah.
Like, oh, American, yeah, history. Like, I think that's his best work.
Well, and he also is a history buff, which is another thing. Like he famously says that, like, when he's at the beach, he'll be, you know, reading a World War II book or something that's, like,
yes,
22,000 pages.
Yeah.
All right. So, yeah, that was good. And then the ceremony itself, I mean, I don't know. I guess it was okay. I almost want to say it was a little boring in spots. I also hate the fact that they're still going with that whole, like, you know, for best actress, best actor, where like someone stands on stage and says something nice about each person and then they give the award. Like, what happened to clips? Why can't we just show clips of performances anymore? Like, that works, right? I don't get it.
I didn't notice that, but now I do. I do like clips.
Yeah, clips are great. Let's honor the performance by showing like a couple best moments from the thing. And this, I don't know. I don't get it. But the biggest surprise of the night was Demi Moore did not win. She was widely expected to win. And Mikey Madison won instead for Anora. Anora was the surprise of the night, but not Tim, because Tim said,
not to me,
5 months ago, best movie of the year. That's what he said. And the Academy agreed.
The Academy agrees. They actually come to me and they ask, what should
they do? They should.
So here's a question I have for you.
Yeah.
This is a controversial idea. With all the websites and the tomato meter and the all these reviews that are out there, and everybody's uncle has a review, and all, everybody's two friends have a movie podcast. Do you think that the Academy Awards has lost a little of its power?
Maybe. There's always, like, every year someone decrying the death of the Oscars and, like, oh, 2 million less people tuned in. But at the same time, there's still, like, a bazillion people that watch the Oscars all around the world, not just in America. We're talking millions upon millions. So it's never going away, and it's never going to lose that prestige. Like, there is, it's still, now maybe someday it will, but to this day in the year of our Lord 2025, it still matters if you've won an Oscar, and it still matters to Hollywood folks. It just matters. So I think it's still relevant.
Okay. All right. I'm with you.
Yeah.
I was just curious because I know that, like, I hear more and more that people will talk about the, like, what is its rating on Rotten Tomatoes?
I know.
Before I hear anything about if there's an Oscar, if there's any kind of Oscar buzz.
Sure. I will say that, like, your average person doesn't care about Oscars at all, and so it means nothing to them. It still matters in the industry. But Rotten Tomatoes, I have been an advocate of Rotten Tomatoes since I was in, I mean, since literally I was in high school, probably ninth grade. I've been, like, the early iteration of the site where the tomato was, like, pixely. I have been a Rotten Tomatoes fan, and that still is the best judge of a movie's quality simply because it's just odds. If, like, you have professional, it's only professional critics on there, and if 10 of the 300 think it's a good movie, then it's not a good movie because most people hate it. Then these are professionals. If, on the other hand, if only 10 didn't like it and the rest did, then it's probably good. It's just simple odds. So I love Rotten Tomatoes. I think it's a good litmus test, and I also don't think it's bad that producers and, like, are like movie studios have to chase a good tomato reading. That, I mean, just, like, sorry, you got to make good movies. And if you didn't, then that's on you.
Yes.
Yeah.
All right, man. I love it. I love this. I love your take on this. That's what I was hoping for. I was hoping for a little passion here, and I felt it.
A huge defender of the tomato meter.
You love the tomato meter.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of want to look at it one day, see what it looks like.
It's great. It works, man. Go, if you're not a believer, this is what my challenge to anyone who doesn't use it or doesn't believe in it. Type in some of your, like, what you think are the best movies ever made. See what the tomato meter says. Maybe your mind will be blown.
What I'm thinking is I want my own tomato meter where I can come into a movie and it will tell me if it sucks. Like, as soon as I walk in. What do you think?
As soon as you walk in to see it?
Yeah, like, they have thermometers, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you're going to see a movie and you're in the theater and it's, like, kind of green.
Beep, 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 beep.
That's so stupid.
And if the movie sucks, it'll tell me, like, before, like, well, I have time to get my money back.
So you're going to get into the theater, find out it sucks, and then go back out and change your tickets? What if the times don't work? This is a terrible system. I don't like it at all.
Hmm. All right. Well, I'll think it through.
Think it through a little more.
It may have applications. I don't know.
What was that old person movie theater you wanted us to create? It was like
prostate vision or something.
Yeah, it was prostate theater or something where it has like 7 bathroom breaks. And then we're going to add this tomato thing. Okay, good.
It's like
this
Old Max, I think.
Old Max. We're really onto something. You and me, we're going to go into business together. It's going to be great.
So can I tell you something that happened? Because you know how we're always saying, oh, no, these kids don't love movies. These kids hate movies, blah, blah, blah.
Oh, yeah.
They don't want to go to the theater. The kids suck.
Yeah.
So the stereotype is that these kids will watch by themselves on a phone some movie they like. Okay, so my kid said, Dad, I need to get tickets to the Minecraft movie.
My kid too?
Yes. So I got my son tickets to the Minecraft movie. They dress up like in little like suits, like I guess like one of the characters. They all dress up, a whole bunch of his friends. They pre-order their tickets. They all have a whole row to themselves. They get there, and the theater is sold out.
Wow.
Not a single thing. And here's the part that was so cool. The interaction between the audience and the movie. He was like, Dad, this is the coolest thing I've ever seen. People were like clapping and yelling and freaking out in the movie and responding to the characters when they did something that was like, you know, in character for the video game or whatever. He's like, it was the coolest movie experience I've had. He's like, everybody was like freaking out the whole time.
Uh-huh.
And I was like, yes, that's it. That's cinema. That's Back to the Future. You know what I mean? That's
right.
It's blockbuster stuff.
I think what's hard for us is Minecraft Oh, so if you're speaking of the tomato meter, Minecraft is not high on there, and it's legitimately, I think, a bad movie, but it's almost like it doesn't matter. In fact, my kid comes up to me 2 weeks ago and also wants to pre-order tickets to this thing, which surprised me because he never does this. He wants to go with a friend. It's a big deal. So then I get him the tickets. I also arrive at the theater and see all of these kids dressing up like they're outside putting their costumes on. Right. And so then my kid, I'm like, how was the movie? He was like, terrible, just like I wanted it to be. It's like there's an irony built in. Like, they know it's going to be bad, and that's the fun of it. I don't know. It's great.
Whatever it is, they gathered. This is what I like about it. They associated and gathered in public to do something.
Yeah. That's like, amazing. That's really beautiful.
It's like rare these days for kids to like – and yeah, they might have been on their phones a little, but they were there and wearing costumes and having a good time. And together, and they felt a sense of community out of the deal. And it was like way more than it was a movie that like it went way beyond. It went into that zone where I know I've been in movie theaters before when people have to like do talk back to the theater. You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And there's something magical about that. It's like you can't get that in your front room.
Yep. And we don't have to understand it. And we don't have to sneer at the movie. It's fine. It means something to their generation. And they gathered together in one room to celebrate it. I mean, that's really cool. I love it.
It was very cool. I was like so pumped because I was like, oh, because this theater will always mean something to these guys.
Yeah.
Like they're going to go, we couldn't have done this at home. We couldn't have done this on a phone. We couldn't have done this even in a basement of somebody's house. Yep. This theater was this group of people that were all gathered and had had energy, you know? Mm-hmm. And there's something magical about that, even with a crap movie. If people are like invested like that and together, that's very cool.
And that's what we always loved about the theater. I'm so glad it's being passed on to the next generation. Beautiful, man. Yeah. Thank you for that. All right. So if you thought that we would retire our favorite segment of the podcast, you are mistaken. We are still going for it in 2025. Tim, hey, what have you been watching, man? What have you been watching?
Okay, did I already mention Bad Monkey?
No, you have not mentioned Bad Monkey. I want to hear about Bad Monkey.
Okay, so on Apple TV, there is a novel that's a Carl Hyacin novel, who happens to be a fly fisher. And it got adapted into a two-season show. I think it's two seasons. No, it's just one season.
Okay.
It's a one-season show with Vince Vaughn, and it's called Bad Monkey, and it's a sleeper. It was like not – I didn't know anything about it. I had a friend tell me about it, and then I couldn't stop watching it. It's a mystery plot, but it's really, really, really funny, and it has – of course, Vince Vaughn, so you have a middle-aged protagonist, which is a lot of fun. Yeah, it has a lot of stuff going on, a little magical realism, set in the islands. It's pretty great. Murder
nice.
Mystery.
Apple TV, how many episodes are we talking? Approximately 10?
I want to say like 8 or 10, yeah.
Okay. Vince Vaughn, you know, I like, he. People kind of down his humor. I always found him legitimately funny and charming ever since Swingers. I think he's got a vibe about him that I dig. Yeah. Definitely.
Yeah. And who can hate him in Dodgeball? Nobody.
Dodgeball, yeah. Well, good. That's the first time, I think, in the history of the Cinema Faith podcast that you have recommended a TV show. This is like, this is beautiful.
Hey, man. It's based on a book, okay?
it's based on a book.
You know, like a literary giant, okay?
Totally. Awesome. Well, I've got some TV show recommendations too. So first off, I want to shout out Severance on Apple TV. Tim, you're already on Apple TV. You got to check out Severance. This is the water cooler show. This is like the show. This is like since Lost, you know, back when you used to like have a mystery and everyone's watching and then you go to the office the next day and you're like, did you see what happened? Did you see? And you talk about it. That's this show. But for the streaming era, man.
Oh, man. I have heard people talking about Severance at work.
Yep. So the premise is simple. They've developed a procedure where you go to work and your brain just like shuts off or doesn't shut off, but basically it doesn't remember what happened at work. So you go to work and then you go home. Like, and so you're never working. Your real self is never working, but there's a part of you that's always working because that's the part that only like remembers what happens in the office. And so there's a split there, right? And then the problem is, and since you never remember what happens at work, the work abuses them and like there's some weird, really weird stuff going on at the company, but you don't remember because you don't remember what happens at work, but your inner self that is always working knows about it and tries to get messages to your outer self. And anyway, it turns into this whole big mystery and like it is really slick, well-made prestige water cooler TV, Severance. You got to watch it. Season 2 just landed in its entirety. Tim, you got to watch it.
The irony of it being water cooler, because it would be something you do in your non-work time that you bring to the office.
Yeah, it's great. Yeah. So there you go. And Ben Stiller, man, he's like kind of the executive producer behind it, and he directs a lot of the episodes, and he is a very underrated director, just has a really efficient, crisp style to his directing. So, yeah.
He directed The Cable Guy, I think, didn't he?
He did do The Cable Guy, yeah. All right, second show, also on Apple TV Plus. Tim, you're already there. You can watch all these amazing shows. This show is called Silo, and what this is a... what? Have you watched it? You've watched it.
I've seen part of it. I've seen, I think, the first episode.
Oh, okay. Yeah. So basically, that premise is that everyone is born, and you're born into a silo, and this is the way people have been living for 150 years. No one knows why we're all in the silo. Some stuff went down a long time ago, and the outside air is toxic. We know this because sometimes people get really like, I want to go, maybe the outside's fine, I want to go out there, and they go out there, and then there's windows, and they see that person fall over and die. So they're stuck in the silo, but there's something else going on, and maybe the outside isn't toxic, and maybe what they're showing on those screens isn't real. Who knows? It gets crazy, and I'm only on episode 3, but I am intrigued. Silo.
My neighbor loves this show. He thinks it's the greatest show ever. So it must, you know, and he's got good taste. You got good taste. So I think everybody should check out Silo.
Yeah, and Rebecca Ferguson, who is an amazing actress, she was in Dune and Mission Impossible and a whole bunch of other stuff. She is like leads the show, and she's so good. So yeah, Silo and Severance. They're actually both seasons are 10 episodes, so you could back to back those, and that's a delightful sci-fi fantasy treat.
That sounds nice. Delightful sci-fi so it has like a chaser.
Yeah.
If you will.
Exactly.
Nice.
All right, I want to plug one more thing. On Wednesday nights, Tim, on Netflix, John Mulaney has been doing this live talk show that starts at 9 o'clock Central Time. And it is absolutely incredible. It's called Everybody's Live with John Mulaney. And he's just like reinventing the genre. So like, you know, clearly he grew up on Letterman and the classics. And he's just twisting it all on its head and doing the most absurd, surrealist comedy. And it is so delightful, and it is live, literally live. You tune in at 9 o'clock Central Standard Time, and he's there. He announces what the weather is, and then he just goes. And then for an hour, it is like bonkers comedy. So you guys got to check it out. John Mulaney. And here's what's great about it. He has celebrities on, but he doesn't like, they're not on to plug anything. Like, he just has his celebrities come on and sit for the whole hour. And then there's a random topic. So it'll be like cruise ships or getting fired. And so you'll have like weird cross sections of celebrities, like Henry Winkler sitting next to Johnny Knoxville. And they're like talking about getting fired. And then people call in. You call, America calls in and they answer calls. It's just great. So watch this show. Yeah.
I like that. Do they know what the topic is ahead of time?
At the beginning, they announce the topic. Yeah. And then that's what they talk about the whole time. They don't talk about the latest movie of the celebrity. It's just all about that topic. So it's so fun. Love it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It is fun.
All right. So check that out. Those are my three plugs. All right, Tim. Whew. Here we go. We're going to talk about this movie. Our first movie of 2025. And we did not go to the theater because we're
not
so lazy.
Even though we applaud the kids that went to a terrible movie at the theater.
We're like, the theater is so great. Our kids. And then we're like, but we're going to stream.
Man, I'm just going to watch this and bake a cake.
Cake. Call back.
You're all 2/3 a cup of, something just happened.
That goes back to our Power of the Dog podcast where you were talking about the art of baking a cake. Yeah.
While watching a streaming movie.
Yeah. Oh, it's great. So yeah, no, but look, we've earned this, all right? We sat through the 3.5 hour long Brutalist. That's like we get two streaming credits for that. That was a long journey.
That was, yeah, I won't say the obvious, but yes, it was rough.
So anyway, Black Bag is the movie we're going to be talking about. It came out in March 14, so really not that long ago, about 3 weeks ago. Oh, yeah, 3 to 4 weeks ago, and now it's already streaming because I don't think it did well at the box office. But look, it's worth talking about. It's a good movie. So, Tim, how was your streaming experience? Anything notable?
I fell asleep and I had to rewind everything.
You know, I did for also fall asleep for about 20 seconds and been like, no, no, no. I know.
So I had to like rewatch a section like two or three times because I was so tired. And so I like just, but I was disciplined. I was like, it's a murder mystery.
Yeah. And it's not the best movie to fall asleep to because the dialogue is going fast. And
well, it's not really a murder mystery. It's a spy.
Spy traitor, who's the mole kind
blah,
of mystery.
Blah, 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 yeah. Yeah, it's a miss, but it's kind of like a mystery.
Yeah.
So you got to pay attention.
Got to pay attention.
To all the details, and you've got to get those details through British accents.
Yep.
And the subtlety of English filmmaking.
Like, even if you're paying attention and rapt the whole time, you still might be confused. So if you fall asleep for a bit, oof.
You might miss a few things. Yeah, or somebody might utter something that you've never heard before and you have to look it up.
Yep.
You know, like, crumbs and, I don't know, marmalade. And you're like, what the heck does that mean?
Exactly.
Crumbs and marmalade. It means, oh, we've got the perpetrator. You know?
Yes.
So there might be like idioms that you're not familiar with in these films, even though it's Soderbergh.
It's Soderbergh, right. But it is British. It feels British. Yeah. Mine was about the same. I popped it on pretty late on a Sunday night, this last Sunday night. And I also had some sleepy problems, but I did bounce back. Also had to rewind. We made it through it, Tim. I don't know. We're so bad. But it's okay.
Well,
we're getting old. So I guess, I don't know.
This is something to talk about. Certain movies you shouldn't watch at certain times.
Correct.
So this is a kind of movie where you would do well to watch it like at a time where you will not fall asleep. And it's not because it's boring. It's just, it's like technical. You can't like, it's feeding you information the entire movie.
Yeah. This is kind of a Saturday afternoon, 2 o'clock sort of movie.
Yes.
Yeah.
I agree. No distractions. You already cut the grass, that kind of thing.
Yep. Yep. All right. Let's talk about the plot. So Black Bag, first and foremost, this is a spy movie. It's a movie about spies, specifically British spies. And at the center of the story are two married spies named George, played by Michael Fassbender, and Catherine, played by Kate Blanchett. And in the opening scene of the movie, George is told by his superior officer dude that there's a traitor. There's a traitor on the team. And it's his job to suss out who is the person betraying their country and doing shady things. And so he goes on a mission to do that. Is it his wife? Is it someone else on the team? We don't know. So it is a mystery. But at the heart of it, it's also kind of a story of their marriage. And like how they're both spies married to each other and sort of keeping things from each other by necessity, but also like spying on each other. Interesting.
It's a movie about fidelity, faithfulness.
There you go. Yeah, it is. It is.
Which does put it solidly in the cinema faith area of conversation.
Yes.
I think.
I think so too. Yeah. All right, let's talk about some acting. Michael Fassbender as George. I like Michael Fassbender. I've always liked him because he has this energy that's sort of like he's very intense and very focused, and he always like goes really like into his roles, but also he has these like movie star good looks and like a charm. So he can like do anything. He can be kind of creepy, but he could also like be the leading man and be charming. He's just got the package. Always liked him.
He's a sexy chameleon.
Sexy chameleon. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
He hasn't been acting that long. He's only been acting since like his first film credit was 2007. It's not that long ago.
Really? What was that?
Yeah. It was, I don't know, some movie I've never heard of. But he's been in a lot since then. Inglourious Bastards and X-Men. And
Yes.
Yeah. Shame. 12 Years a Slave.
I always think he's been around since the 90s, but he hasn't.
No, he hasn't. The dude played Steve Jobs, too. You know, he's been nominated twice for an Oscar. Best Supporting for 12 Years a Slave and Best Actor for Steve Jobs. Two-time Oscar nominee right there. By the way, much better Steve Jobs than Ashton Kutcher, which probably should go without saying.
Yeah, that's a weird casting, isn't it?
It was not good. Tim, what do you think of what him as George? Michael Fassbender as George. What do you think about this guy?
So he's like an ethical, unethical spy. I thought he was great. I think he's solid. He's kind of the, keeps the movie kind of pegged down a little. Like, I don't know. He's like the solid factor in the whole movie.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
He's like the character we trust.
Uh-huh. And he's ethical. He famously hates liars. He's like, I hate liars. Hates them.
But at the same time, he would kill for his wife.
Right.
And he would lie for her, maybe.
He might even betray his own country for his wife. It's revealed that he really would do anything. He point blank says it. And she maybe is the same.
Yeah.
crazy. He almost had kind of an autistic vibe about him, you know, like kind of very like everything is strategic. Everything's a mean to an end, right? He like goes to his wife and he's like, do you want to see a film? You know, but there's always a reason behind it, you know, which she's like, yeah, what's playing? And he's like, I've heard this one's good, but there's a reason why he picked out. Everything it feels like is some sort of like ulterior plan.
It's a everything's a chess move. And then, like, the impression is that he's just, like, very calm about everything and he doesn't have any emotional connection to – like, his only emotional connection is to his wife. That's it.
Yeah.
It's like he has a sole emotional connection and it's her. And almost the same for her.
What's funny on that front, Tim, and is how he's so composed. Do you remember that scene? And this isn't spoiler territory yet because I'm going to be vague. But do you remember that scene where he's actually not – he's in the office and it's the scene with Pierce Brosnan and he's like, there's a traitor. And he's actually not composed. Like he actually looks nervous and he's like shaking his glass a little bit.
Yes, yes.
That's on purpose. I was reading online and they were pointing out like why would he be composed in every scene but not that one? It's because at that point – the magnifying glass is on him as the potential traitor, and he's playing into it as part of the game. I mean, that's brilliant. That's good stuff.
Yeah, it's pretty good stuff. It takes a lot of work to try to care.
To care?
Oh, I'm like, that's brilliant. Oh, man, that took a lot of work.
Yeah, it's good.
It is brilliant. You had to look it up, man.
Well, I'm just saying, like, because that was the one time that he wasn't composed and it seemed weird. And then it's like, of course he would be. That would be part of it, too.
Don't get me wrong. Like, I think it's very cool. Like,
yeah, it's cool.
It's very cool. It's very novel. But yeah, I would never have known that had you not looked that up.
Yep. I had to look up a little bit because this movie is a little hard on that. In your first view, you might not have all the pieces. It's a very smart film and maybe too smart for its own good because like I there were some parts of the movie that I got to the end and I was like, wait, so what?
Yeah.
Anyway, let's talk about Cate Blanchett. I got a confession to make, Tim. I got a bit of a celebrity crush on Cate Blanchett. My wife knows. And she's okay with it. But let me tell you, this woman is, she's sexy. She's elegant, sophisticated. She has this just energy about her that I find very alluring. And I think that she's, yeah, I don't know. She's great.
John, are you going to date Cate Blanchett?
Did I say too much? No, I did. Of course not.
Are you dating Cate Blanchett?
Whatever. Isn't every married couple have like one person that they're like, oh, Jude Law or whatever? Like every no one.
It's never Jude Law for me.
Not for you. I mean that, but I mean for the woman. Whatever. Anyway.
Okay. All right.
I like Cate Blanchett. I think she's great. She's also, though, what's great about her is she's not afraid to be messy because she is like played some characters that are like disasters. And so it's not like she's just like above, you know, she's always got to be put together. She, like Blue Jasmine, for instance, is actually a great Woody Allen movie.
Yeah.
Yeah. Where she just like is a train wreck. She throughout the whole course of the movie, she devolves into a train wreck. And it's really fascinating. So anyway.
Yeah. She's like unpredictable in this movie, which I think is what you want. You're like, can we trust her? I don't know if we can trust her.
Right.
Is she totally like throwing away all of her marriage for this? Like, is this happening? Is she going to betray the one person that she's been loyal to for her whole life? We don't know.
Yeah. Right.
So I think that like she comes off as ruthless.
Ruthless. Like she would kill you if
thinking. Yeah.
Exactly. Cate Blanchett has also been nominated for 2 Oscars. We have the two leads of this movie with 2 Oscar noms apiece. Cray cray.
That is crazy.
Marissa Abella. I wanted to mention her because she plays Clarissa. I don't know if you remember her in this, but like she's also in this other great show on Max called Industry.
Haven't seen that one.
Anyway, I thought she was good in this too. She's a very young actress kind of starting her career. Only got a few things to her name, but she was great in this too. And Pierce Brosnan is in this movie, Tim. Pierce Brosnan. There he is.
I like Pierce Brosnan. Do you know what I found out about Pierce Brosnan?
What'd you find out?
For years and years, I thought he was English. He's Irish.
Oh, yeah, I did know that.
I didn't know that. Anyway, just something to think on.
I almost think he was underused in this movie. He was great. I liked him.
I like him, too. I think he's great. There's nothing I always will remember him as Remington Steele or whatever.
Oh, yeah.
You have no idea what I'm talking about,
right? I don't, because my generation will remember him forever as James Bond, because GoldenEye was the game of our generation on the Nintendo 64. It's just what you did every weekend. You go to your friend's house and play GoldenEye multiplayer, and there was Pierce Brosnan right on the cover every time.
Yeah. Bum, 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 bum. Yeah, I've played GoldenEye in college.
Great game.
So, yeah. So, but like I always, so Remington Steele, you should look this up, viewers, listeners, whatever you are. It's Pierce Brosnan's breakout television role. It's very odd. Remington Steele.
Okay. Yeah. Remington Steele. Is it bad? Is he bad in it?
No, he's not bad. It's, but it, it, you might think it's a bad show.
Okay.
I mean, if the name didn't help you.
Remington Steele. Just sounds so soap opera.
It's very gunsy. Like Remington Steele. It's like guns.
Wow. I was thinking, gosh, this is how like out of gun culture I am. I literally, to me, it sounded very flowery, like Remington Steele, like an estate. And it's
like
actually
Victorian.
Yeah. Now you're talking. It makes sense. It's like basically guns and steel.
Right. Colt Winchester. Right.
Right.
Yeah. It's like that. So Remington Steele. So you guys can check that out for early Pierce Brosnan.
Wonderful. What was Pierce Brosnan eating in that crazy scene where the fish was alive? Like the fish was alive and he was going to eat
it. Whatever it was illegal.
Oh, yeah.
She named it she named the dish. She's like, this is illegal in England. But it was some kind of, I think, sushi dish.
Well, but yeah, but the fish was like, the fish's mouth was moving and it was definitely alive. It was very like cannibalistic. It was like, we're going to eat you alive, bro. Sorry. Yuck. Don't do that. I don't like it.
Yeah. So does that like give us like a clue to like who this guy is? Is that he would travel, he would go out of his way to eat a live fish illegally.
Illegally.
For the novelty of it, because he could.
Yeah, of course. That's a good window into his.
So that tells you he's got a weird, he's a weirdo.
Yeah. Which of course, I think all men in power are. It's very weird. All right. Let's talk about the music. I love the music in this movie. Music by David Holmes. And I was thinking as I was watching, I was like, this movie kind of, the music kind of reminds me of Ocean's 11. It's got that very like snappy, jazzy sort of thing. Well, I've come to find out David Holmes was the composer of Ocean's 11 and has worked with Soderbergh on many films, which is another Soderbergh movie.
Dang, look at you.
I know.
Look at the, you're a connoisseur.
So you had all this research now? This is, I'm turning over a new leaf for the season. Yeah.
I'm like really impressed with you, John. I feel like I add nothing. You're adding everything today.
That's okay. It'll probably just be for this one, and then we'll go back to being hacks.
Well, I like that. I've never left being a hack. You're the one that's you're changing, John.
I know.
I don't know changing. Do you think you could still maintain fidelity to me now that you've changed?
I want to, Tim. I want to be committed to you. Forever.
You're not going to watch me while I'm in Zurich, are you?
Zurich? No. I'm not going to redirect the satellite. I would never do that. Never.
I don't know, John.
The 3-minute window scares me too. I can't get anything done that fast in 3 minutes. That's just, anyway.
I agree. It's like I can't even get to the podcast sometimes.
Exactly. So yeah, David Holmes, he did Ocean's 11. He did a bunch of great scores. He also recently did the score for The Apprentice, which is a movie I actually highly recommend. And I think no one wants to watch a movie about Trump these days because he's sort of in our face all the time. But this movie is very eye-opening and revealing, and it reveals a different side of Trump. And it also juxtaposes him with this other guy, Ray Cohn, who like was a Trump-like figure that kind of taught him everything he knew. But then kind of learn in his later life regrets the person he becomes. So we see Trump sort of start off as this sort of blank canvas that this Trumpy like guy imprints on, and then Trump solidifies into that guy, but the guy who taught him everything sort of regrets everything in later in his life. So anyway, it's a very nice juxtaposition, worth watching, I promise. And anyway, David Holmes did the score for The Apprentice.
All right.
But good music in this movie. There's the point. Like, very, didn't you think it's like has this very, like, bum, 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 bum. You know, you're just like, it's a spy thing.
Can I be honest? I did not pay attention to the music. I almost always do.
Yeah.
But I didn't for some reason.
That's fine.
But anyway, but it's good.
It's good. I thought it was good. I thought it stood out to me.
Mm.
Let's talk about the writing. What did you think about the writing? Did you appreciate that part of it?
Yeah. I mean, I think it was, it's like, it's smart, dialogue heavy.
Yes. snappy dialogue, very back and forth.
Yeah, right. So it's like you get the feeling, what this does is these people are obviously like very intelligent, top 1% of people. That's who they're portraying, to the point where they would have to, that they're in an intelligence scenario where they are critical members of this team, right? Mm-hmm. So they're that smart. I mean, they've got some of them got PhDs, this and that. They're smart, they're strategic, they're metered human beings. And I think that the dialogue was written for them in a way that, like, if you've ever seen a spy movie where the dialogue isn't written like this, it seems like you have Ricky Bobby as a spy.
Yeah. It has to be at this elevated level for it to like actually be believable as a spy movie or something.
Yeah. I mean, the it's kind of like snarky grad student language.
Yeah. So like they'll be in bed, right? George and Catherine will be in bed and Catherine will be like, we're going to make this dinner party where we're going to like figure out who the traitor is. And then Catherine will be like, so what is your plan? And his response is fun and games. You know, so it's just this, like, everything's in double entendre and, yeah, exactly.
What does he say? So, something about, like, that may make a mess only if we do our job well.
That's the kind of dialogue we're talking about. Yeah.
Ooh, it's so bad. It's kind of, like, unrealistic. It's like people who are quick enough to, like, formulate something clever. Mm-hmm. Like on the spot. I'm not that person. But so that's how it's written. It's written a little bit, I think, written a little bit more than real.
Yeah. It's a little surreal. So the writer is David Coop, who is a very famous writer in Hollywood. If you've ever seen Jurassic Park, he wrote the screenplay for that, among many other movies, including Tobey Maguire's Spider-Man, The First Mission Impossible. The dude's been around, made some classic scripts. So David Coop, good dialogue. Good script. I liked it.
Yeah. It accomplished what I think what it intended.
Mm-hmm. And it was efficient. This is a 90-minute movie, right? I mean, I think that is great. And like, it's just because it also fits Soderbergh's style. He gets in, gets out. You know, he's not going to fuss around a lot. And also, as I was reading some Reddit comments, someone said, I think rather brilliantly, that in the hands of a lesser director, this movie would be 2 hours and 20 minutes long with a chase scene. And I think that's absolutely correct.
Oh, yes. There was no chase scene.
Yeah.
But it did have a Scooby-Doo scene.
Yeah, that's true.
with like a lot of explanation and flashbacking. Yeah. Correct, yeah.
But it didn't insult your intelligence. Like, I sometimes the flashbacking and the over-explaining at the end, you know, drives me crazy. They didn't do that. It was
I think they
smart.
Did do that.
Do you think they did?
They didn't explain everything, but it was like a... You know, it felt just like at the end of Scooby-Doo when they unmasked Mr. Withers and they're like, oh, you thought you were so smart, Mr. Withers, because you did this. There's a little of that going on, John. Let's be honest.
All right. Well, I was still confused about what happened at the end, so I don't think they over-explained it. I think it was smart enough to be like, yeah I don't know.
So the one failure, I think, is the gun scene.
Why? I thought that was a great scene.
You didn't think that gun was unloaded the whole time?
I didn't think that. It's not, again, very outside of gun culture. I would not have even thought of that. But what I liked about that scene is when the perpetrator, the traitor, reveals himself by picking up the gun, Cate Blanchett says, oh, I forgot to say the title of the game. But what is it? What was the title of? Shoot, now I'm...
Was it whoever picks up the gun is the... I don't know.
Yeah, see who picks up the gun or something like that. See, I've totally ruined it. But anyway...
It was something smart, not what we said.
Right. It was very smart, and this is not smart.
This is why we're not writing scripts.
I forgot the title of the game. See who picks up the gun. It was something like that. It's very nice. So I like that scene. I also like the lighting in those dinner scenes because it's like this weird sort of like... pod lighting from the table, and I thought it was kind of beautiful.
So let's talk a little bit, like, the set design plays into the whole thing.
Yeah, I agree.
Everything is like windows and screens and like cold.
Mm-hmm.
It's not even mid-century. It's like this like real cold architectural style.
Yeah,
it's like tons of angles and everything's clean and there's never any clutter. Everything is matching the characters, like the whole environment in which they find themselves.
Yeah.
It's all that way. So it gives, like, tonally that set design is, like, really critical, I think.
Oh, great.
Like, even in the kitchen, right? Even when he's cooking, it's like you don't get a warm feeling about it.
No.
You're like, this is methodical.
And his glasses are fogging up, and he looks so creepy. And then he gets a little of the sauce on his sleeve, and...
has to change his shirt.
Yeah.
Most people wouldn't change their shirt over that.
No, not me. I have stains on my shirt all day, every day. What are you going to do?
Right. So if, and it was a tiny, tiny little bit of sauce. He's cooking in a white shirt. So like, this tells you everything. He's cooking in like a $200 white dress shirt. And he's making sauces in this shirt. He gets a little sauce on the sleeve and he's like, I have to change.
Yeah.
So yeah. Anyway, it tells you about his personality. It's a little bit tightly wound.
A little bit. Maybe sociopathic even. All right. So let's talk about Soderbergh. Steven Soderbergh has been making movies for a long time and he's made a lot of them. And he, so what's, here's what I find really interesting about his career. He got started with an indie movie called Sex, Lies, and Videotape, which made a big fuss on the circuit, and that brought him fame.
That was like, when I was a kid, that was like totally controversial. I bet it's not even that bad.
Right, exactly. It's not even that bad of a movie. But like, it, or not, I mean, like, as far as content, it, like, that title was so like provocative back in the, what, 90s. But anyway, it was a very, it was a big hit on the festival circuit. So that made him a kind of like a name to remember. And then his best year, unarguably, was 2000. He came out with two movies in the year 2000, back-to-back, Aaron Brockovich and Traffic. And each of those movies, the same year, received 5 Oscar nominations. So that was a total of 10 Oscar nominations in 1 year for two movies that he made. I mean, that was like
That's crazy. I didn't realize they were made in the same year.
Same year.
Are you sure?
Same year, wow. and up for Oscars the same year. Yeah. So he had just a banner year. But here's what's so fascinating. After getting 10 Oscar nominations for movies he made, he just like kind of abandoned that whole prestige awards thing and just made genre films from that moment on. Like, that's just what he was like, you know what? I did that. That's great. And then he just did his own thing. So Ocean's 11 was the next movie he made after that. And everything else since then has been that kind of vibe. Solaris, that, you know, that sci-fi film. Full Frontal, which is like this sort of like indie movie about the Hollywood types. Bubble, which he shot on like camcorders. Magic Mike. Contagion. Like, what happened to the guy that made Traffic and Aaron Brockovich? He just doesn't care. He's like, I'm just, it's so fascinating.
That is so weird because I look at those films are so different than this film that
exactly.
we just watched.
Exactly, yeah. I think Traffic is one of the best movies ever made. It's one of my favorite movies, and it is an absolute masterpiece.
Yeah. I mean, I guess, like, they talk about he's got nonlinear storytelling is, like, his thing, right? Okay. But I do think like the emotions that are involved in Brockovich in Traffic, like you have heavy amounts of humanity going on compared to like the film we just watched, which is very icy, very cold.
That's what I'm saying, is that like those two movies, he showed that he can make movies about the human condition and characters that are waxing poetically about like the meaning of life, right? That kind of Oscar bait movies. And then he just abandoned all of that. And it's like he's just making these indie movies that sort of get in, get out, honor the genre, nothing really more to it than what it is, right? Like this movie, like there's no monologue that brings it all home about like our place in the universe or something. It's just a spy movie. 90 minutes, reveal the traitor, and you're done. Roll the freaking credits and let's move on. That's Soderbergh now.
The other part is this about human relationship?
Right. There is a little bit, I'm underselling it a little bit because the marriage element at the center of the movie is kind of fascinating and does elevate it beyond just.
Yeah. Is there something like will a personal relationship ever trump a like obligation to the whole? Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, like, will you ever turn your back on your entire society for the sake of an individual? Like, that's a big question.
It's a big question. Well, let's get to that in just a second, because I want to hear your thoughts on what do you think Soderbergh brings to this film in particular, and what are your thoughts on him in general? What do you think about him?
I like him. I don't understand him. This is very snappy. Mm-hmm. It's paced well for something that's basically people talking the entire thing.
Yeah.
Like, in contrast with, of course, the one that we always use, which is the Manhattan Project one.
Oh, Oppenheimer.
Yeah. Like, contrast with Oppenheimer. Oppenheimer is smart, too, but this is, like, smart and paced. And, like, I feel like I can hang with this one. Oppenheimer, like, you're falling asleep.
Right. Yeah, it's very snappy.
I guess
we
did fall asleep in this.
Well, we both did fall asleep. We're bad test cases. Very snappy, yeah. Very like very economical. That's just, yeah, it's his vibe. I don't know. It's good. But I always struggle because, so like if you take a writer-director like Paul Thomas Anderson, right? So that guy's going to be shooting for the fences every time. That guy basically wants to make a masterpiece every time. And he wants to make something that is like has something to say. And, you know, and so I prefer that over someone who's just really good at like tidy economical genre films. But there's something to be said about the brevity and just like the honoring whatever the source material is without being too pretentious or fussy about it. I don't know. I guess I appreciate that.
Yeah, I do like it. So I think his economy is like exactly right. So he has a certain economy to it, to his filmmaking. And I do think like the dial, everything matches. I know it sounds weird, but like everything, like, so from his, the way he does cuts. So he does like these really fast cuts.
Yes.
So the cinematography, the storyline, the mood of the lighting, the mood of everything is like matches. I don't know how to explain that.
Yeah. It's like mise-en-scene, right? It's like everything is servicing the whole. That's how you're supposed to make movies. Exactly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So it's like even the, like, it's like everything blends into itself. So like, I thought he did a good job of that.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about it. This movie is pro-marriage, Tim. We have a pro-marriage film. It's great. Fidelity. It's interesting. So yeah, it is revealed that Catherine and George would basically do anything for each other, including betray their agency and their country, murder, lie. And by the way, this is someone who famously hates liars, and he is willing to lie and betray his own values for his wife. That's how much these two respect the sanctity of marriage.
That's interesting.
But is it? So yeah, so let's talk about that. Is that right? Right? I think this isn't as simple of a question as we think it is. Like what I just presented, maybe most people would say, of course you shouldn't do those things just for your marriage. But I always hear, whenever we're talking about pacifism or protecting your family, there's always people that come out and say, of course, if any member of your family is under any serious harm, you must do whatever you have to do to end that harm because you have to protect your family. And that's basically what they're saying in this movie. They will do anything to protect each other. So is that right? Is there any credence to that morally?
Yeah, I don't know. I think that's like it's the good question. It's like, it's the personal loyalty versus like kind of care for the bigger system, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know. I keep thinking about when it comes to this stuff, like I think about the psychologist in the movie.
Oh yeah, right.
She has like religious convictions, and that's what leads her to like turn this guy in or whatever. Is that she's got these religious convictions that would say we can't have all these people die as a result of our actions.
Yeah.
And therefore I have to like personally, I have to do something that would be personally harmful to me in order to, so she acts in a way that's like not helping her, but would be like, we'd save lives.
She has more of an obligation to the whole than this one particular relationship.
Right. Because of her religious leanings.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, she's willing to sleep with people in order to get like advantage. So I think human beings, I guess the point I'm making is like, I think human beings are complex like that.
Yeah.
Like, I don't think we're not like all moral or all not moral or more well or loyal just to one another and not to the system. But I think as far as this goes, like, I think that is like a tendency that we do have, which is that we would look at the things, the people and right around us, like in our immediate orbit as being reality.
Mm-hmm.
And that we would betray like the greater good for those people.
So it's interesting. This is kind of playing out before our eyes in the political sphere, because J.D. Vance said in an interview when he was sort of asked about ending USAID and the millions of people that are now potentially going to die from us pulling back on all these programs that were saving lives and everything around the world, he made a religious moral argument and said, look, what I believe and what is taught us in scripture, he claims, is that you basically look out. It's a concentric circles, right? You look out first for the people in your own family, then you extend one step beyond that to the people in your community, and then blah, 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 blah. And that is his justification for this sort of America first. We need to take care of our people before, way before we start thinking about taking care of any other people. And that was his argument for that. And I think it raises an interesting question, because it's exactly what we're talking about. Are we loyal just to the people in our circle, or do we have an obligation beyond that?
By not caring for the vulnerable, we are impacting our immediate circle.
Ah.
So we're telling our kids, we're telling our closest associates, we're telling everybody that it's okay to not care for the vulnerable. So to say that we're not caring, that that doesn't impact them, that's bad logic to me.
Mm-hmm. It's a false dichotomy.
Yeah, he's using this like airplane, put on the mask first kind of crap.
Exactly.
That's not what we're talking about. They just cut a whole bunch of aid to vulnerable people. And coming up with some weird rationale for it to me that's just insane. So anyway, you're hitting some of the passion I have. And even if you look at both Bush administrations, they would never have done anything like this.
Oh, absolutely.
So it's not partisan. It's particular, if that makes sense. Like it's particular to this administration. But when you start cutting off food aid to people, and then try to justify it by saying we're taking care of our own families and stuff like that. That to me is, oh, so you're double selfish. Mm-hmm. They're starving people and you're trying to justify why you won't help them.
Yeah. And I don't think that's what scripture teaches, because when you get into the gospels, you know, Jesus basically point blank says, who is your neighbor, right? Or the person asked Jesus, who is your neighbor? And we're told that our neighbor isn't just our neighbor or a family. It's actually everyone, because we're all God's children and we have to look out for all of our neighbors, including our enemies. We're supposed to call to love our enemies. So there's this higher standard that Jesus calls us to that is not just protect the ones you love. In fact, what's that verse that's like, oh, you, maybe Jesus said this himself, I think, you love those who love you, you know, great. Everyone does that, right? Like that's not special. That's not like virtuous.
Yeah, he does say that. I think self-sacrificial love is at the heart of who Jesus is. I mean, he is that.
He embodies that. Mm-hmm.
I also wonder, like, okay, so we're in like the wealthiest country in the world, super high standard of living. When are we going to like be able to go, oh, okay, well, we took care of ourselves and now we'll take care of everybody else. Right. We're the wealthiest country in the world.
We're the wealthiest country in the world.
So when do we take care of somebody like starving people? What do we need? Like another, like we have to all have like 3 iPhones first. I don't understand. Like, do we have some threshold for when we're okay?
Mm-hmm.
Vance's argument doesn't answer that, because he's saying, no, we're not okay. Things are too hard for us to be helpful to someone else. So like, well, wait a sec, when are things going to be good enough? Because they really are good. If you look at the context of like, we have the best standard of living.
Mm-hmm.
Well, high, not the best, but we have very high standard of living for a lot of people, largest economy. What's the deal? Like, when are we going to be like, what are we going for here?
Right. And if people are struggling, why? With all that money that we have and all the resources we have, why? That's a good question. We should ask ourselves that. So George and Catherine, that's what they believe, man. They will do anything for the sake of their marriage, which is in one way kind of wholesome and go marriage, but also may be problematic when you start to think about the real world implications of family first. It's interesting to ponder.
Yeah, so it's like a low form of so like personal loyalty. There's some places in scripture that advocate that, right?
Like you need to take care of your family. It's not like throwing the baby out with the bathwater. It's not like just abandon your kids for the sake of the world or something.
No, I got the kid. Yeah, the kids part, but even like your partner or whatever. Okay, I see that there's, but I always look at like, when we look at scripture, it's always sacrificing for the community, not just for the personal loyalty. And so I think that like just looking out for one other person might have some drawbacks.
Mm-hmm.
Like if you're just looking out for them and them only, then I think your obligation to the society can be compromised.
Yep. All right, Tim, what are your final thoughts on Black Bag and your letter grade?
I think that it had incredible acting that carried it, a good script. And it seems like you could have done a budget version of this with BBC actors. That would have been fit for Sunday night on PBS. So I'm going to give it a B minus.
B minus.
Yeah, not because it's a bad film, just because I don't think it was so original, fresh. There was nothing that was so like new about it that it would require all these good actors to pull it off. I think you could have done this with a lot of different people. I think they're great and it's fun to watch them work, but I don't think that this required all of that.
All right. Tim's first grade of the year, B minus. I'm going to disagree, and I'm actually going to give Black Bag a B plus. B plus. I think this movie is very well made across the board. Tim talked about how every element is working for it. I agree with that. The acting is great. The music, the writing, the directing, even the lighting and set design, I think is all working towards something really slick and cool, and just it's a very smart spy thriller that you'll be thinking about afterwards and going online and figuring it out afterwards. And I think it works, but B plus, because I cannot give something, even though it's pretty much impeccably made, I can't give something in the A range unless there's some sort of themes that kind of extend beyond just what's happening. And to me, this movie was very like, this is a spy thrill. It's a genre movie. And then it gets in, gets out, and does its thing. And there's no like, there's nothing more than that. And it's not like that every movie has to be like that. It's just for me, that's the difference between the B range and the A range.
Okay, so you've convinced me. Can I raise my grade?
Yeah, well, sure.
I'm going to B, not B minus.
B. Yeah,
I think
B.
This is a solid B. Because you got me. You convinced me, John. John doesn't always convince me.
No.
But today he did. Is it? No, this has all the elements. It's just missing, like, it's missing something. But it has, like, the things that make for a decent film. So it's a decent film.
All right. It's a B. Good. Actually, Tim, you're the one who usually convinces me to raise my letter grade. I'm always like the, like, it's a perfect movie. And I'm like, A minus. And then by the end of our talk, I'm like, you know what? That's happened many times.
You can't find a ton of fault with this movie. So like it has to be a B, but it's not so great as to be an A.
Exactly. Right. There are elements missing that keep it from the A range. And it's also not a movie that you're going to be like, oh, let's watch Black Bag again. Like, I mean, you maybe one more time.
Now that I own it.
Now that I own it. Right. I know. Maybe one more time. Like I would be interested in watching it one more time, but it's not something you're going to revisit on a regular basis because you know what I mean?
Yeah. That's the problem with these mystery types where like you have to figure out who done it. It's like once you know who done it, it's hard to watch again.
Right. So yeah, we both did buy the movie. So listen, Black Bag, here's what we'd recommend. This is streaming, but it's streaming for a very high price tag right now. In about a month, this is going to be on something. Paramount Plus, Apple TV, it's going to be somewhere, right? At the very least, it's going to go down to like $3.99. Don't buy this. I think we both agree, don't buy it.
No, don't buy it. I only bought it because John made me.
I know.
Actually,
I feel so bad.
Actually, you didn't. You didn't. We were like, hey, I'll give you access to mine. And I'm like, no.
Yeah.
Now, and that said, like if we lived in the same town, we'd probably just watch it together.
Right.
But anyway, so now we're $50 in.
$50. Now look, I know that sounds terrible. $24 to buy it. Now, I always still have to go back to the fact that a movie ticket is 13 plus popcorn. You're
coming out better.
Yeah. Yeah.
You're coming out better this way. Yeah.
But it does kind of hurt occasionally. So anyway, wait for it. Wait for the $3 rental or when it's going to be free on one of the apps. But worth watching once. We both agree this is a movie worth watching once.
Yeah, and if you have like a bunch of smart friends that want to get together and guess who done it, this should be and they like the crisp dialogue, this will be great.
Yes. Good. All right, Tim, let's talk about future plans for the next couple of months here. So here's what I'm thinking. Unless something dramatically comes up that is worth seeing, and I don't think so. I'm going to have to look at the calendar, but what I'm thinking we're going to podcast on next, you know Bong Joon-ho who did Parasite? Back in 2019,
yes.
Best movie of 2019, I think.
That was a good film.
He's made another movie that came out last month called Mickey 17 with Robert Pattinson, where it's some sort of like social satire on a dystopian type thing.
I've heard about this movie.
Where Robert Pattinson can like die and then come back to life. Over and over and over and over and over again. So that's what it's about. So I like him as a director. I think that's another movie worth visiting and talking about. If we can't come up with something else, that's probably what we'll do. That would be another movie that's streaming. And then, but we'll see. But then in June, what we are for sure going to do, Tim, and you're going to hate this at first, but listen, we've got to do Mission Impossible, The Final Reckoning in June. I know. Don't shake your head at me. Listen, three reasons. Number one, I love Mission Impossible. And if you have not, if you are not on board the Mission Impossible franchise train, please go back and watch these movies. Skip two. Do not watch Mission Impossible 2. But every other one of them is so worth watching and so exciting and so awesome. Tom Cruise never fails. Number two, the reason why we have to do it is that we actually have plans to go see this with the Burns in the theater, and it's going to be like a cool theater experience to talk about. My whole family is excited about this, and we're all going to the theater to watch this with the Burns. So we've got something to talk about. And then finally, number three, it's June. It's the summer movie season, Tim. You got to give me one action popcorn movie. Come on. It's June.
But this is like a Quadicle or whatever.
You got to do it.
What number of film is this? You don't have
to go back and watch all the Mission Impossibles, though I highly recommend it. All you have to do is go back and watch the one that came before this, because this is the sequel to that. So the first one was Dead Reckoning. This is the Final Reckoning. So just go watch the last Mission Impossible and you'll be up to speed, and then you can go into this fully prepared. It's all good. Please.
I've never growled at you till now, John.
This isn't until June. You don't have to do this next. This isn't until June. But anyway. Man,
it seems like it's too soon to go.
It's going to be great.
So what number of film is this in the franchise?
I'm positive this is eight. Eight.
Oh, gosh. You're making me see the eighth film in a franchise?
Which is why this franchise is so great, because it's still good after all these movies. But, Tim, you don't have to watch all of them. Just the last one. I promise you're going to be into it. I promise.
You watch the eighth installment of a film franchise?
It's not like it's a consecutive franchise where you have to know what's going on in all the movies. They're self-contained stories.
I'm not saying like I won't know what's I'm not saying that guy that that's an issue. The okay. issue is the eighth installment of any franchise ever good?
That's what I'm saying, is that these movies are good all the way to eight, and that's what makes it so special and why we all need to get on board this. I'm telling
you,
John, you
know I'll always complain. I'll always whine.
And then you'll do it?
And then I'll do it.
Because you love me, and we are committed to each other, just like Catherine and George.
Yeah, plus maybe I'll learn something. Maybe there'll be a final reckoning for this movie where it's terrible and we can mock it.
It's not going to be terrible. Promise.
Do you think it's as good as Dead Reckoning?
I don't know, because I love Dead Reckoning. I gave that movie like an A-. Like the last Mission Impossible movie. I'm telling you, they're that good. They're that good.
Are there any other kinds of reckoning?
This is the only other reckoning. Anyway, all right. So yes, next month, maybe Mickey 17 or something else that will stream. Then June will be Mission Impossible. That's the plan, y'all. Keep the faith, my friends. Tim is growling at me and very angry. So we will see you all next time.